Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Gerardo Ceballos, one of the world's leading ecologists and a professor at the Institute of Ecology at National Autonomous University of Mexico. He's the author of numerous books, including The Skin of the Rainforest, Mammals of Mexico, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. He's also known for his field work on prairie dogs, jaguars, and others. He proposed the first Mexican Endangered Species Act that includes roughly 4,000 species of plants and animals in the country. He has seen through to establishment more than 20 protected areas that cover almost 2% of the Mexican land territory and protected thousands of plants and animals, including around 15% of all endangered species. No other Mexican scientist, perhaps no other individual scientist in the world, has accomplished so much in hands-on conservation. Today we talk about biodiversity and the book The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. So first, thank you for your great work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for you to inviting me again to talk to you.
I really enjoyed our first interview. So to start our second interview, I would like to just start with the question, with the statement from your preface, humanity has unleashed a massive and escalating assault on all living things on the planet. So can you talk about sometimes we hear some extraordinary things about what so much of this planet was like before this assault started. You know, these herds of bison that would last for days as they would go by, or flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time. Can you talk about some of those? Just talk about in some places some stories about what the fecundity of life was like before this culture started its assault.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, as some of the examples that you mentioned are prime examples of the abundance of wildlife. Just let's think that there used to be around between 40 to 60 million bison in the prairies from Mexico to the U.S. and Canada. Just imagine 60 million animals on those areas. And within very few years in the 18th century, we wipe them up. In 60, 40 years, the 60 million animals become less than 4,000 and so on. As you mentioned, the passing of the pigeon, a very, very famous ornithologist, Wilson, in the 1800s, managed to count just one flock who has 2 billion birds. It passes through day and night for 2.5 days and nights. And it was the width of these animals, of this flock, was around 1 to 2 kilometers. Can you imagine that? Or prairie dogs. Now they are reduced to a few, probably more than a few hundred thousand scattered in small colonies from Canada to Mexico. And just one single prairie dog town in the 1800s was 450 kilometers long, and it probably has more than half a billion animals. It was just a single colony. So what we're talking about now is the abundance of wildlife was so big that it was it is really difficult to imagine. Largest herds of elephants right now is probably 500 animals, no more than that. And those flocks are in places like the Chobe National Park in Botswana. But before that, I mean, just at the beginning of the 19th century, some people used to see flocks of 10,000 elephants. So what we're talking now is that we have been able to inflict such a tremendous losses on wildlife that we can see now is really a mere cartoon of what it used to be. The studies, recent studies have shown, for example, that the big fishes on the sea, for instance, sharks, rays, tuna fish, and so on, there is less than 2% of the abundance that it used to be in 1960. So within very few decades, we have lost 98% of those animals. And even now, if you go to the, for instance, to the migration of the rays in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, you may see 10,000 rays in a single day, all of them flocking together, going from one feeding grounds to the other. just imagine what used to be probably 40, 30 years ago. So that abundance, it is very difficult to recreate or to understand. I was just recently in Antarctica, and I was in some places where you can still see some abundance of some of those animals, like the penguins. And I was in colonies with thousands and thousands of penguins. And sitting down there, I just could imagine that life on Earth, there will be many, many places with abundance of animals, such as the penguins that I was looking in Antarctica, similar, until very recently.
You know, even, well, two things. One is that there are accounts that are studies that are happening recently that along the eastern seaboard of the United States, that the populations of many songbirds have decreased by up to 80% in the last 40 years. And that broke my heart when I read it, until I realized that 40 years ago was after Silent Spring, which means that there's been an 80% decrease since the 1970s, and that was on top of a previous huge decrease because of pesticides, and that was on top of a previous huge decrease because of urbanization and habitat loss. And so even those huge losses we see are even the horrible losses we see, or like you said, 2% of what they were in 1960, and compare what they were in 1960 to what they might have been in 1500. So these population collapses are on top of previous population collapses.
That's exactly right. That's a very, very good point. Exactly, because, for instance, in places like in Mexico, in the Guadalupe Island, you can go now and you can see some sea mammals like lions and elephants, seals, and so on, and you can see, for instance, 20,000 or 80,000 and so on, and that's a lot. But the early accounts in the 1800s, they say there were probably 500,000 animals. Exactly. Although they have been protected, there are a lot now, apparently a lot. But that number of animals that we see now is still a very small fraction of what used to be there on those islands before. So what you're saying is exactly correct. The big, big decreases that we have seen, been able to document, like the elephants and so on, are a part of the history where we were able to document them. Those animals have already been in a big decline for other reasons in the 1700s, 1800s, and after the revolution, the Industrial Revolution. So what I'm trying to say is lots of the things that we have been able to document are in places and with animals that were already have suffered a lot before we were able to have good numbers to count them and so on, good techniques to count them and so on. So in Africa, for instance, recently there were some census of primates in the last 20 years, and the decline has been exactly as you say, 70-80% of the primates in those areas have been lost. But the records indicate that when we start to study them on those areas, they have already have a 50% decline. So what we have seen, what we're seeing throughout the world, is that we have lost 80, 90, 92-something percent of the original populations of all those animals, the population that they used to have in the 1700s or 1800s. So there is a study by the World Wildlife Fund that has shown that wildlife in Latin America, you know, is it's probably the most diverse region on Earth, and it was somehow a spur of big, big impact in the 1800s and beginning of the 1900s. It wasn't the impact wasn't as bad as the one has happened in Southeast Asia, for instance. But this study has shown that, in general, Latin America has lost from 40 to 60% of all its animals in the last 40 years. saw the big flocks of macaws in Mexico. There are accounts that there were flocks of 3,000 macaws. Now, if you see one with 8 macaws, you will be incredibly lucky. So this is why in this book that we call the Annihilation of Nature, because I really didn't like to put a title that would be alarmist. But on the other hand, what we really happening on wildlife across the world is really a massive assault on all kind of creatures. Because what we have to remember that by destroying the big animals, from rabbits to coyotes to wolves to lions to elephants and so on, well, by destroying them and reducing the populations to so few that they don't play any longer the ecological role that they used to play, what we're doing, we're affecting the whole thing, the whole balance of nature, and it is called. So we're losing all the small parts, small or big parts, of this machinery that makes life possible on Earth. And when we start to research this book, and I'm happy to tell you that the book has been selling very well, and it has got really good reviews, in the sense that I think this is what this is telling me is that people, that like non-scientific people, are really keen on understanding better these issues and try to do something. When we put together the book, I wasn't really aware of so many things happening in the last 10 years. Although I am pretty, I think that I'm pretty good in keeping track of the scientific and the popular literature on endangered species and extinct species. But I found there it was incredibly sorrow in many cases. And even now, when we send the book to press, the book went to press probably at the end of 2014, I don't know, maybe September 2014, just within 1 year, really bad news happened for lions, for elephants, for rhino. Just last week, the very sad news that the Sumatran rhino had become extinct in the wild. And it really broke my heart because it's one after another, we're losing all those species, big species, conspicuous that we can count them and see them, but on the same time, we're losing so many inconspicuous species. And the question here is, for how long are we going to wait until we do something that is meaningful at the world level? Are we going to wait until it's too late for humans? Or are we going to wait until there is just a barren land with no wildlife left? Can we enjoy going to a national park in Tanzania, for example, without seeing lions, without seeing hyenas, without seeing hippos, without seeing rhinos? So those are the kind of questions that are pushing my work, and in this particular case, this book, to try to make this tragedy very well known to lots of people, and trying to make us act and stop this massive loss of species and populations.
So, and I think that most people who are paying attention have seen this in their own personal lives too. I know that, I mean, it's bad enough that it is Sumatran rhinos and it is lions, but I know my mom is 83 and she often says that she is, she's happy that she's glad that she's not younger than she is because of what she'll see. And even in the last 10 years, she's gone from putting out in the spring and summer 5 hummingbird feeders a day and having all the hummingbirds fight over them to only 2 hummingbird feeders, and oftentimes the food goes bad because there aren't enough hummingbirds. And so in their personal lives, people are seeing, you know, fewer chickadees or fewer...
That's right.
This is once again not just affecting out there, these huge megafauna. I've noticed it where I live that the old timers here will say that they used to see groups of 100. This is only in the 1970s or 80s. They would see groups of 100 rough-skinned newts. And I first moved here 15 years ago, and I would routinely see, in the right time of year, I would see 4 or 5 rough-skinned newts at a time. And now I see maybe 3 or 4 rough-skinned newts a year. And that's just in 15 years.
That's exactly right. That's right, because, I mean, and we mentioned it in the book, and what you're saying is exactly correct, that we have seen the changes everywhere. As you said, if you are a bird watcher and you go around your city in Mexico, in the U.S., in Europe, wherever, you have seen big declines of these animals, big declines of the birds that are arriving to the winter or summer grounds. For instance, in Mexico, the monarch butterflies, the first time I went to see the monarch butterflies, there were more than 200 million butterflies wintering in Mexico. And a few years ago, there were probably not more than 3 million, and they are starting to recover a little bit. And this is because mostly the use of pesticides in Canada and the U.S. They destroy the food sources for these animals. They come to Mexico. There are not enough because there are not enough numbers. It's a really bad winter, and many of them die. So from 200 million, just imagine, to 2 million, the last time I was there, I said, well, what's this? There were just probably 20 trees with butterflies. And the first time I was there, there were probably 1,000 trees with butterflies. So we're seeing the changes. And the changes, as you said, are affecting now. First of all, was the big megafauna, the big animals. And this is a very big problem because now they're affecting animals, small and large, animals that are perceived as good or bad, animals that are colorful, animals that are inconspicuous, and so on. So basically, what is happening, we have a tipping point where our activities are affecting basically most of the plants and animals on Earth. Few animals and few plants, then species, get somehow taking advantage of the new conditions. But in general, everything is being lost. In the U.S., there used to be 2 million prohorn antelopes, and the species apparently was in very good shape. Nobody has to worry about it. And in the last few years, the population has been crashing because there has been too much impact on their habitat, too many fences, too many hunters, and so on. So species who used to be incredibly abundant and nobody will worry about it, it is in bad shape. There is another example that I like to say, is that many of these changes in population numbers that are pushing species to extinction now can happen incredibly rapidly. And for instance, the cold in the eastern shores of the U.S., there used to be a very important fisheries. And for many years, between 200,000 and 300,000 tons of cod used to be caught. So in the 1960s, 70s, some technological breakthroughs make that the catch went from 300,000 tons to 800,000 tons in very few years, 3 or 4 years. So everybody was very happy. There was plenty of food. But then within 3 years, the population collapsed almost to extinction. It basically disappeared. Now, the scientists have also discovered that the few cod that are still there may probably become extinct because the water on those particular in the Chesapeake Bay has increased 1% more, one degree centigrade more than it used to be like 40 years ago. And at that temperature, the small, the baby cod cannot complete their development properly. So they will have to do something to help the species, otherwise it will become extinct. So what we're seeing now in nature is because of all the changes, pollution. Just imagine if you're an animal or a plant, a wild animal, and you have to face habitat destruction, habitat deterioration, roads, infrastructure, pesticides, new invading species, competitors, and pollutants and so on. There are so many things that you have to face that all these species, many of these species, simply cannot cope with so many things. They're just collapsing. So one thing that we mentioned in this book that I think is very important, in many places on Earth, what we have seen, if we manage to remove one or two of those stressors or the most important factors causing the decline of this species, some of the species can rebound. But we have learned one of the important news in the last years has been that many species, if you help them to take out some of the stressors, some of the activity, human activity that are causing their decline, they can come back to proper numbers. And for instance, one of our study sites in Costa Rica has only 7% of the native forest left, but it's a matrix of plantations of yucca, banana, grasslands, and some remnant vegetation. So when we start to study there, like 15 years ago, hunting was really important for locals, and then it was reduced almost to nothing. Now hunting is almost negligible. And then the populations of many species, including mountain lions, ocelots, sea otters, and so on, are coming back in really good numbers. So the good news is, like, if we manage to really stop the massive assault of pollutants, of hunting, and so on, we can really get back some of those species and so on. So the story goes like this, and we, in the book we put the last three or four chapters talking about that. It's what we can do, to save and all these species. One thing I like to say is by saving those species of plants and animals, wild plants and animals, we're saving ourselves. Because we have to remember that we really basically, the conditions that make Earth livable for us and for all animals and plants is because of the wild life, the wild plants and wild animals. So basically, by working and saving all these species and making whatever natural habitats are there or areas who are being used by humans but not so intensively, we can make those areas more livable for more plants and more animals, wild plants and animals, then we can really increase the probabilities of those species not to become extinct on the one hand, and we can enhance the capabilities of those habitats to produce welfare for humans and for wild plants and animals. And I think that's like one of the critical things we have to do in the next few years. We really have to work on how can we manage the areas that have been impacted by humans so we can have more wildlife. On the other hand, I think that we really need to change the way we do things. There was an editorial 2-3 days ago by this very important scientist from NASA, who is one of the top climate scientists on Earth, and he has been diagnosed with a pancreatic cancer, stage 4, so he's going to die soon. And what he said there is how he has devoted his life to try to face global warming, as we are doing, for instance, with the endangered species and the destruction of wildlife. And at the end, what he said that is very important is that he thinks that if we humans put our act together and we act, he thinks we will act because the problems are piling up that are visible, as you said, at all levels, from local to regional to global level. What he said is that he has a hope that humans will react as in the Second World War, in which basically so many countries collaborated to face the big problems, and eventually Earth managed to pass through these incredibly difficult times. So in this particular case, I think we have to work really hard to stop trade of endangered and illegal trade. And for instance, we have to really push China and other Southeast Asia countries to follow up the international law that says that we cannot trade animals, that they have to curb the illegal trade of wild animals. Just a single trader of an illegal guy trading animals in Philippines recently has 3,800 individuals of a species of terrestrial turtle that the estimated population, total population estimated was 3,800 animals. So probably he has most of what is left of the whole population of this species, and he was trading it. We need to push governments in the U.S. to stop hunting wolves in Mexico, to stop hunting parrots in Europe, to trade with salamanders in China with ivory and so on. So if we like to see these animals survive for the next 20, 30 years. And I think if we manage to keep them for the next 20, 30 years, we will be in a much better position to really save them for the long term.
You know, that the thing you just said reminds me of what my dear friend and environmental mentor, John Osborne, has often said about why he does environmental work, which is he always says, we can't predict the future, and as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is that if the bull trout are still around in 20 years, they may still be around in 100, but if they're gone in 20, they're gone forever. And so he basically is saying, you know, not on my watch. I will not let them go down, and I will do whatever it takes to help, you know, this particular forest remain, this particular river remain, this particular species remain. And it sounds very much like that is what you're doing too.
That's exactly right, because I have understand, and most of my colleagues understand, that people think that it's too late. We don't think it's too late, and I think the critical issue is we manage to maintain most of these forests, most of these rivers, most of these species within the next three decades, four decades. I'm sure there will be many solutions then that will help us to keep them forever. So the big battle, the big battle, the fundamental issue is to try to make things better in the next two to three decades for all of us, and especially for the plants, the wild plants and animals on Earth. And I think then humanity will see a better future. And when people hear the Mexican president or the minister of environment or other people like that ask me why we should keep on fighting, this is exactly what I said. Because if you have them, there is hope. If they are gone, there is nothing we can do, you know. It's exactly what your friends have said. And I'm happy to that you mentioned his example, because I think so many of us have come to reach similar conclusions from very different perspectives, from many of us, of the people working for understanding nature, scientifically speaking, and for doing conservation work.
Well, something else you're saying keeps reminding me of something else other people have said to me, which is that so many, especially indigenous people, have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that means to me, and one of the things they've said to me, is that means making your loyalty, switching your loyalty away from, you know, the primary loyalty being to the system and the primary loyalty being to the plants and animals. And it seems like once somebody makes their loyalty to the salmon and to the prairie dogs, then it becomes a lot more clear what sort of actions we need to take. But the important thing is to make your loyalty to them in the first place and then act from there.
And that's exactly right. And what we have seen in the last few years is that this is happening throughout the world. Just recently, right now in Mexico, in southern Mexico, the government gave a permit to destroy close to Cancun, you know, this very big resort, to destroy some mangrove area, like 200 hectares, like 400 acres of mangrove to a development. And right now, people is fighting the police. I mean, they're going and fighting the police and fighting it because it's illegal, because it's wrong, because their loyalty went from being passive, a spectator of the destruction, to be active, activists and trying to do it. And in the same time, we're looking at the legal, all the laws that have been broken and so on. So, but what has been incredibly nice and important is to see all these people, from taxi drivers, and most of them are people really, really who are surviving day by day from their work. And they leave their work for 2-3 days, and they won't get any money for them, and they will have to somehow cope with that, for fighting for the mangroves in that area. And this is when you know that the system has changed, on the one hand, that the loyalties, as you say, have changed to something that is more meaningful, and that people have decided, when people decide to take action, even if we lose that mangrove or we lose that particular forest or whatever, the whole thing has more hope, because basically it's telling us that people is understanding that saving that mangrove, saving that forest, saving that species, the bottom line indicates it's saving themselves.
So this is a different subject. Can you talk about the importance of protecting large pieces of land for what is the importance of protecting large pieces of land for biodiversity?
Well, as we have seen, most of the, right now, a little bit more than 50% of all the natural habitats, land habitats in the planet has been already been impacted to less or greater degree. So what is left is incredibly critical, because we need large areas in order to keep the ecological function. In other words, we need large areas so we can have enough population, a viable population of wolves or the big animals on the one hand, but also to be able to keep the cycle, the hydrological cycle, the biochemical cycle, all those cycles that are intermingled with life and with life and the environmental services that we get from nature. So large areas, the larger the area, the better, in the sense that also large areas have more species. There are a few rules in ecology, because it's so complex and we understand so little about how things interact and how biodiversity function. But one of the few rules that we know is the larger the area, the more species there are. So just by protecting, let's say, if we have 1 million hectare protected area in Mexico, and we manage to increase it to 2 million, we're increasing by many fold the number of species that we're protecting in that area, on the one hand, but also all the benefits that the population in that region or the world are getting from that. It's not a forest, they say, that a 2,000-acre forest that not work and doesn't do the same work like a 20,000-acre. And the change is not direct, it's not aromatic, it's not arithmetic, it's more, there are many synergies that happens only when you have those large areas. And basically what we people that study these kind of things and try to do conservation, one of the things we say is also it's like a precautionary principle. The larger there is the area, the most likely is that it will be able somehow to withstand the big changes that are coming because of global warming, for example. So having that area, then it's fundamental to keep larger populations of plants and animals, and the larger the population there is, the lower the extinction risk. Also, larger areas have more species per se. Larger areas work better and keep better the ecological function and the services delivered for humans. And the bottom line is that we have destroyed more than 50% of everything, forests, tropical forests, temperate forests, grasslands, deserts, and so on Earth. So we think that the rest is just critical to be able to sustain and maintain the system before collapsing.
So I just want to... You mentioned monarch butterflies before, and that makes me think of something that I think quite often, almost every time I see a migratory songbird, is that of all the creatures getting hit hard, it seems to me, given all the damage that's been done, it seems to me a miracle that there are any migratory songbirds or migratory creatures at all, because if at any step of the way the habitat link is broken, like you could have the rough-skinned newts I mentioned earlier, in their whole life they might travel over 1 square mile. And so if that area is protected, that's one thing. But for dragonflies who migrate, or for monarch butterflies who migrate, or for chickadees who migrate, what that means is that they have to have 20 different habitat places that are all still intact for them to survive. That the fact that any of them are surviving this assault seems completely miraculous to me.
It's very miraculous, but it may work both ways. If you are a species who are restricted to a single area, and something happened to the area, you're gone. So
right.
A species more restricted and much more vulnerable than migratory species, because also remember that the ecological system, the nature is very dynamic. So somehow, I mean, the miracle that they are seeing there is because they have some adaptations, you know. They have in their past experienced big changes on their habitat, and then somehow were able to cope with them. So just imagine that you're on one of those birds that used to go to an island, and this island suddenly burst because of a volcano. Unless this particular species find a way to survive, it will have become extinct. So I think the miracle of the migratory species is that they somehow have faced comparable situations in the past, and that has allowed them to be able to cope with these changes. The problem is, if we continue destroying everything, there will be eventually a point in which those species don't find any place to rest, any place to feed, any place to fly when they are traveling. And there are examples like that, and there are really some really neat examples. Examples where the people have looked at, for instance, some migratory birds, and then they have looked at where are the, like they call, stepping stones along their migratory route that they have to be protected. And by protecting those areas, they know now that the species, or one species or several species, can complete their migration. So in that particular case, on the other hand, some migratory birds on some migratory species, like the monarch butterfly. If the forest in Mexico, where they overwinter, who are very peculiar, very particular kind of forest, find alone at just very, very narrow conditions of temperature and precipitation during the winter, are gone, probably not the species. The monarch butterfly won't become extinct. But the migration, the phenomenon of the migration will become extinct. And it will be incredibly sad because it's the only one happening on Earth at that scale.
So this is also a different subject, but this is something that that bothers me a lot. A lot of people seem to believe that that what humans are currently doing is just being incredibly efficient at exploiting everybody else, and this is just the way things go. But the question I always ask is, how did the world get to be so full of life in the first place? That it seems pretty clear to me that the way life really works is that the salmon actually make life better for the forest by their existence, and the redwood trees make the forest better by their existence, and everybody is supposed to actually contribute to life. That's the only way that life could have gotten more so diverse and so brilliantly full of life in the first place, is by every creature contributing by its life and death.
Well, let's remember that evolution has no direction. So what you're saying is partly correct, in the sense that right now we have the highest biodiversity ever recorded on Earth. And this is the result of 3.5 billion years of evolution. So basically, a species who wasn't particularly good at exploiting certain resources and other was better, one become extinct and the one, like the one species of salmon become extinct and the other survive because it was better and getting those resources. So the complexity of life, basically, as you say, is that all these species are surviving right now, have survived because they have been able to fit different niches and contribute with their activities to the whole system, to work, the working of the whole system. So the problem with humans is that we are copying right now more than probably 48% of all the primary productivity on Earth, meaning that obviously this 48% of energy used to be used by many, many species, and those species don't have now that energy because we're using it. So just by definition, by taking so much energy, one species is pushing many other species to extinction. And this hasn't happened before. This is the first time in the history of life on Earth that one species can cope so much resources. Before, as you say, they were all so finely tuned, so one species would pollinate, the other species would disperse, and so all the resources were all the resources were so finely divided and so exquisitely organized by the 3.5 billion years of evolution that suddenly one species, especially in the 100 years, start to cope massively those resources that is pushing so many species to extinction. And in this book, in the Annihilation of Nature, in our book, what we mentioned is like in the history of life on Earth, there have been five massive extinctions. It's what we call the mass extinctions, you know, extinctions that because changes, natural catastrophes, like the meteorite hitting Earth or volcanism or changes in the sea level and so on, has caused five times that mass extinction. And a mass extinction is defined by a really rapid, in geologic terms, really rapid extinction of many species. And rapid in geological terms, we're talking about thousands to hundreds of thousands to million years. And then it implies that many species, 70-80% of all animals, many plants become extinct, you know, and it was caused by natural causes, by a massive impact of natural catastrophes. Well, what is happening now is humans, we're acting as one of a natural force causing a mass extinction. What we say in our book, in a paper that we published last year, is that we're entering a mass extinction, the sixth mass extinction. People have said that before, but we have provided very good information that this is caused by humans, and it has all the characteristics to be considered a mass extinction. The massive loss of many species very quickly and by one force, in this case, humans. And the problem with this is that by entering in the sixth mass extinction, the difference with the five previous ones is that this is incredibly rapid. The species, we have incredibly good data showing that the species of vertebrates, mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fishes that become extinct in 100 years would have taken 10,000 years to become extinct if under the background or normal extinction rate. So we're losing species so fast. And the problem with this is that we know also by the previous mass extinctions, that dominant species, like us, usually don't survive the mass extinction. So we think with incredibly solid data, that by putting so many species to the brink of extinction, what we're doing is we're reducing the capabilities of Earth to maintain human civilization as we know presently. So even if we don't change our loyalty to species or plants and animals because of the ethical, the philosophical, the moral, and so on, other reasons, just in terms of we were selfish, letting those species to become extinct is pushing us to the brink to extinction, to humans. That's why it makes it even more interesting, because there are so many reasons. But even if you will be very, very selfish, the best way to go is to prevent the extinction of this species.
So if you, we've got like 3 or 4 minutes left, and if you were to look back at, first off, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 58.
Okay, I'm 55. And if you were to look back at the end of your life, what would it look like for you to, let's say you die in 25 years, what would it look like for you to look back at the end of your life and be satisfied that that you had accomplished what you set out to accomplish in stopping the annihilation of nature? What would that look like if you were to, if your work were to succeed as great as you could hope?
Well, I think just come to mind 3 things. On the one hand, and this is what I put my life, I mean, the objective of my professional life is to prevent as many, the extinction of many plants and animals as possible. And I will think we'll be successful if the, many of the species that are we describe in our book, the annihilation of nature, haven't become extinct. So if by in 25 years, there are still zebras and some lions and elephants and so on, and prairie dogs in Mexico and jaguars, and many of the small species who are endangered right now, I will be incredibly grateful for life, incredibly satisfied. Second, if there were many white areas, I mean, for instance, if the, all the areas that we're trying to protect in Mexico and the world, I will be incredibly happy if we manage to keep at least 80% of those in 25 years. I will be happy. And the third thing, it will be that if in 25 years, we, you and I could be talking again in a radio interview, and at that time, civilization will still be going strong, I will be incredibly happy, because that will mean that we have done what we have to do to keep humans on Earth with all the species of plants and animals that have been with us since the dawn of our existence. I will say that at that moment that I will be, I have been successful and I have been good on doing what I have trying to do for my professional life.
Well, thank you. The book is The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals by Gerardo Ceballos, Ann Ehrlich, and Paul Ehrlich. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you for being on the program. My guest today has been Gerardo Ceballos. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.